Colonel Upchurch, Reel 1. What was your family background, sir?
Well, we always have lived in Norfolk, and my great uncle actually was chairman of the county council for a number of years, and we were very proud of him. He was actually director of Lloyd's Bank. And my grandfather was brought up at Sheringham Hall, where the family lived, but he was a parson, and he had lots of children, and therefore we weren't all that well off. But I was allowed to go to Uppingham School, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I was lucky to be moderately good at games in the 15 and the cricket level and so on. We had, at that time, the commandant of the corps, the OTC, which was affiliated to the Royal Leicester Regiment and wore the tiger cap badge, the RSM and the RQMS, they were all in the 1st Fifth Battalion of the regiment in World War I as the commanding officer of the RSM and the RQMS, and therefore they persuaded all of us who wanted to go in the army to join the Royal Leicesters, or the Leicesters as they were then. So there were actually, when I was left in about 1927, there were as many as, I think, 8 serving in the Leicesters at that time, Tigers as we were called, and they were all great friends of mine. I was told by my father that I'd better go into my uncle's solicitor's business, because it was a good one in Manchester, and I'd have been much better off if I had, but he had no son. But after a time I decided I wanted to go into Leicester's, and so I was applied and accepted to go in through the back door, which is the supplementary reserve, which I did. I joined actually in Northern Ireland. We were in Londonderry for 4 years. We had the time of our lives there. We had no casualties, and we had nothing at all. I played rugby football and I played cricket for Londonderry, and I played actually golf for the golf club there, which was actually in the Free State, and provided I played adequately, they didn't care a damn whether I was a Protestant, a Roman Catholic, or a Hottentot. But there it was. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. And then I went from there. We went from there to Aldershot. We had Wavell as our divisional commander and Horrocks as our brigade major. But before that, I had applied to go into the Sudan Defence Force, because so many of our friends of mine had served in there, and they told me all about it, and I knew that I would enjoy the life and I would enjoy serving the Sudanese. I liked the way they ran things there without any fuss or bother, and furthermore I appreciated very much the extra pay that I was going to get and the long leaves that I was going to get. And therefore I was delighted when eventually the Khan asked me, agreed that I should go into what I saw in 1937. But it was a difficult thing to get into, because unless you had friends in it, I believe, unless you were a very special chap, you couldn't get in. And all my friends very kindly almost perjured themselves to get me in.
Would you in retrospect have joined another colonial regiment, say the KAR or the WAFF, with equal pleasure? Or do you think the SDF stood out amongst the colonial regiments?
I consider the SDF stood out a mile, in my opinion. And the thing really was that it was perhaps unfair to compare them, because you had to have, before you could go in there, you had to have 5 years service, and therefore you were a bit more mature, and you were given far more responsibility, and you were made to live in your own house and that sort of thing, whereas in the other things it was more or less like serving in the British Army overseas, and you lived in messes and more mess kit, and there were messes of you, and you hadn't got all that amount of responsibility. It was quite different. I wanted something different. All my friends had got mad, and I wanted to get away from all that sort of thing, have something new, and I knew I could enjoy it with the SDF, and I had far more responsibility out there than I had serving at home, and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the whole life.
Did you expect service abroad to affect promotion within your own regiment?
Well, it might do, but the thing really was that, I didn't worry about that at that time, because at that time promotion from subaltern was taking about 17 years. I thought I might easily be dead by then because I thought the war was coming, so that didn't worry me. But there was no doubt about it that if you went on for a long period, that you got out of touch. And after you'd served for, say, 5 years out there, it was ordered that you go back for 6 months to your British regiment to get yourself updated again so as you weren't completely out of touch when you went back. Most of them, actually, if they did serve as long as 10 years, most of them left to go into the Sudan service after that. But there's no doubt about it. For instance, to give you an example, if I may, that when I returned in 1944, I never heard about battle orders and all that sort of thing, and I'd never worn battle dress in 1944, and they thought, what a freak is this? So it only goes to show, you see. And I had a bloody hard time to get myself in at all.
What exactly were your conditions of service in the SDA?
Well, you were originally sent there for 2 years on a 2-year contract, and then you did 2 years, and then you had 4 months leave at the end of your 2 years. You had no leave except local leave in either Egypt or somewhere around like then your first year, but at the beginning of the second year you were invited to extend your contract to 5 years, in which case you had 4 months leave in that second year. Otherwise, you either were told you were not required anymore, in which case you went at the end of the 2 years and had 4 months leave, or you were allowed to go after 2 years. If you went and extended for 5 years, you had 4 months leave in your second year, and then you had 3 months in the next 2 years, and then in your last year, at the end of 5 years, you had 4 months leave. But the great thing about those leaves was that you could arrange your journeys home as you wanted, and you were given so much money to do that, and people spent hours talking how they were going to go home. And there were a variety of ways. I mean, some people wanted to get back to a girlfriend quickly, and they went quickly by air. Others wanted a real sort of whirl and where it went, and the smartest ship possible, and what they did was nobody's business. And others went on all sorts of ways, some going completely by road the whole way. And others quite often met friends and relations in Europe, having gone sort of, you know, from Alexandria across the Mediterranean. So it was all great fun, and we used to swap ideas and sort of think the way we were going. I never did it because the war came too soon for me, so I never had a leave like that. But that was typical of the SDF, and typical of the ways that they did things, which I thought was much better than some others.
If the war hadn't come, would you have stayed on and extended your contract? Or would you have just done your one tour of duty?
Well, I decided not to stay on because I wanted to serve with my regiment, because we all felt that we must serve with our regiment, otherwise we'd be in war, otherwise we'd be completely finished from a regimental point of view. And we all felt that. And actually, we all applied to the Kaid, saying we want to go home, we must fight with our regiment. And we all felt that. It was quite extraordinary what we did. And we had no idea of sort of what was going to happen and a certain notoriety which we were going to get. And we were told that provided the commanding officer of our regular battalion would take us, and we had to produce that in writing, we could apply every 6 months and we would eventually go. Well, when war started, naturally, we could not go, because we could, we'd learnt a good deal about MMT companies and that sort of thing, and the way of life and treating the Sudanese and the Sudanese officers too. And furthermore, we could talk a certain amount of Arabic. I mean, I knew no grammar, I couldn't write and I couldn't read it. But because I had Sudanese servants who couldn't talk English at all, I had to talk Arabic perpetually. I remember on one occasion, my servant Hassan Adam, who was a wonderful little black man, I used to say to him, Dershanu, which means, what's that? And he would say, well, that's Tarabeza, which is a table. And I'd say, what's that? And he'd say, Kursi, and that's a chair. But I got it wrong, and I said, give Tarabeza. And he would bring a chair. When my friends came in for a drink, they said, Hassan, why do you bring him a chair when he's asked for a table? He said, well, he doesn't understand. And he pointed his shaking finger to one, and he said, what's that? And I've said one thing, and he says, and I know what he means. So much easier.
Did you have any formal instruction in Arabic?
Not officially. We were responsible for getting ourselves, but we were given special Sudanese people in the schools who we had to pay, who used to come on their days off. On the Friday was the holiday, they would come up and talk to me and teach me a certain amount. But the thing really was this yellow book, which we had to learn when we went out. Then,
which yellow book was this?
What?
Which was this book?
The book that I told you about, which was written by Bin Bashi, with 100 phrases and things which we had to learn, and as many as possible as well as that. And he had his problems, and he'd written them all down. They were invaluable to us. But there was always somebody who was... who could teach us and tell us enough. But we were on our own in our own houses. And if, naturally, we had to order our own food and drink and that sort of thing. And we used to give it, and I used to call for my boy, and I used to have to write down what he wanted. And then the cook came and said what he wanted. And then I used to give the cook a certain amount for things which he could buy in the market. And then, on top of that, the size, which was for our horses, used to come and say what he wanted, and he was given so much. And it was very, very necessary that we used to have to know what we were about, otherwise it would be done.
How long did it take you to become proficient in the use of the language?
I don't think I ever did become proficient, but I knew enough to get by. I knew a mass of words, and that was it. I knew no grammar at all. I mean, if I'd stayed on longer, I'd have had to have done very special exams, writing and that sort of thing. But as the war came, it was far more important for me to learn masses of words and issuing of orders and listening. And I had the ability to know a lot of words. And the Sunnis, if you were taking orders, what worried me very much was that the Sunnis naturally expected to be told their sentences, one thing or another, in Arabic. But there were always somebody standing there, one of the officers, or one of the Sunnis, RSM, or that sort of thing, who could talk what was known as Bin Bashi Arabic. And they would... the sentence would be read out, and you would then say, have you anything to say? And they would possibly say, to you exactly like a Scottish or a Welsh chap, and you wouldn't understand them in any case. And then you would say to these chaps, well, what did he say? And he would say in Arabic, he said that he was very sorry, but he got rather tight and went into somebody else's tukla and he did this and the other thing. He said, is that what? And he said, yes. I said, right. And then I would talk possibly in English. He said, what do you think about this? And then he would say, well, I think so-and-so and so-and-so should happen. And then I would have to deliver, I knew the sentences and that sort of thing in in Arabic, and I would then deliver them in Arabic. And I would say, have you anything to say? And then came the problem, of course, and they'd come back and what he said. But the whole thing with the man was conducted in Arabic, although I was very halting in my Arabic.
Do you think you were unusual in not being very fluent in terms of the grammar, or was your own level of proficiency fairly common?
I think I was about normal. I was, in fact, I was better than some. In some ways, I was better than those people who had been in the South and were brought up to us, because they didn't have to talk Arabic at all. But the thing was that I've commanded units in Arabic in the war. Not very well, but I mean, not very well either way. But we got by, and there it was. And I mean, the sort of thing that amused me was that a friend of mine the other day, who was in my regiment, who I knew had been to the School of Oriental Studies, and he saw some Arabic written, and he said, ha ha ha, and I said, Dougie, you know perfectly well I can't read Arabic. What does it say? And he read it out laboriously, and I laughed. He didn't know what it meant. I did. So that is the difference, isn't it? Sorry.
Could I go back a little and ask you about some of the preparations that you made to actually get to the Sudan? For instance, did you have a medical examination?
Yes, but... it was taken for granted, and I regret to say I didn't take it quite as seriously as I should have done, because it was done. It was in my head that I wasn't fit. I was playing games, perpetually, that sort of thing, going for long route marches. And I saw the guide in London, and I regret to say the night before I met a lot of friends and had a few drinks. And when the medical officer said, do you drink? I said, yes. And he said, what did you drink last night? I said, 5 or 6 pints of beer. He was horrified. I nearly got sacked. But, I mean, I was directly told that it would be absolute suicide for me if I had too much drink. And I had to be careful, and we all had to be careful. But the thing was, the political service was far more careful than we were, because we knew we were only going to be there for a year or two, and they were going to be there for life. And therefore, that was rather the difference. But we were very careful on the whole.
You had inoculations, did you, for various diseases?
I presume so, but I can't remember.
And what sort of kit did you amass before you left?
Well, we were sent a lot of instructions of what we should have. And I was very lucky, because Jerry Stainer, who was in my regiment, who was in Khartoum, he wrote to me unofficially and said, pay no attention to this. He said, but don't say I said so. What you must buy in London is this, that, and the other thing.
Can you remember any of the items?
No, not really. But 90% of it I could buy at Vanian's, which is the big store in Khartoum. Uniform, practically all our uniform, that sort of thing. And the sort of thing that I bought out there was all my sort of trek kit and that sort of thing, which cost me pounds to take out there. And another thing, of course, that I was told that I should buy was a mess kit. We in the camp corps, we never wore mess kit. God knows how we got away with it, but we didn't. But we took jolly good care. The only time really when we had to wear a mess kit were at the Governor General's parties twice a year. We took jolly good care that we weren't in Khartoum at that time. We actually had 2 very ropey ones we could wear if necessary. That saved us a lot of money. And of course, everything else, like the other dress, we could buy in Khartoum. And of course, in the evening, we didn't wear mess kit. We could buy incredibly cheaply, lovely silk shirts. Man was wearing one. And we used to wear those, and we used to wear white trousers, and we used to wear the green cummerbund and black shoes, and if ladies were present, we wore a black tie, and occasionally a white coat, but that was our mess kit. And luckily, it looked very smart on all this, because our servants were so good at washing it, which they did every day, and pressing it and making us look as well, quite smart.
Did you receive any official advice as to what to expect in Sudan in terms of the culture or the climate or your duties?
No, because it was taken for granted that I would know, because I talked so much to my friends who were in my own regiment, and therefore they didn't consider it necessary, and I think the Qaid, when he interviewed me, appreciated that.
What sort of questions did the Qaid ask you?
Well, Jerry Staley even wrote and told me what questions he was likely to ask me. But one of the ones that he always asked was, why do you want to join? Well, one of the reasons, there were a variety of reasons. Some people had an unfortunate love affair. Some people didn't get on in their regiment. And others were broke. Others wanted to go because they wanted shooting or polo out there. Others wanted the extra pay, and others wanted the long leave so they could come and play cricket and back home, all that sort of thing. But the majority of us went there because we thought we'd like the life and serving the Sudanese troops and a bit more freedom than we living in a subaltern in our own regiments and not being able to get on for a number of years.
What sort of journey did you have out to the Sudan?
Well, I was lucky because I had an old granny, and she said, I want to see him before he goes. And so, again, we were allowed to go in any way we wanted, provided we got there. And she said, you come and stay 3 or 4 days with me before you go. And so I went over there and had a couple of nights in Paris. And I caught the Amibi boat at Marseille. And then I had a wonderful time until I got off at Port Sudan. But I won't say any more about that, but it was completely the greatest fun. And I remember that I joined somewhere in January, and I can remember to this day a Burns night that we had.
So it was generally very gay company on the
boat,
was it?
Oh, yes.
What sort of people were going out to the Sudan with you?
They weren't so much going out there, but they were going out more to the Far East and the missionaries and all sorts and sizes and so forth. It was great fun. I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
What class did you travel?
Well, now this sounds rather snob, but I suppose as a British officer joined the Sudan Defence Force, I suppose I travel first class. I don't know. Well, I really don't know. I mean, I think actually there was only one class on the boat. Now I come to think of it, because I wasn't conscious that I was either a class below or a class above anybody else. I'm talking about no more.
Now, you were posted to El Obeid, and perhaps we can talk first on the domestic and the social side before going on to your military duties of the machine gun company. First of all, what sort of accommodation did you have?
Well, we had these grand little bungalows, which were unfurnished. And we were lucky in El Obeid in a way, because there was electric light in them. Elsewhere outside, there was no electric light. And they were awfully nice. There was one main living room for the summons, and I think I had a bedroom. And then there was masses of room, sort of thing like this outside, and Mustafa and a bit of a garden. And they were ideal for us. I think then if you got on a bit, you had a spare room and so forth. And Bimbashis had a certain type of house, and then the second command had a bigger house. When you became the commander, you had a fairly big house. I mean, it was big enough for Rena and us and three children and that sort of thing to live in, you know, in 1952. But of course, if you were the commander of the Camel Corps, you were expected to do a certain amount of entertaining, because you were actually I suppose the deputy governor was number two, but you were, I think, probably the number three on the list. So if anybody came down, you were expected to sort of put them up, whatever they were. And it was great fun. And that got you intermingled with all this sort of, you know, all the political service. And they were a grand lot. In fact, most of the political service, they were referred to as the lot of blacks run by blues, because they were practically all blues from, although they weren't, you know, they were intelligent as well, but they were awfully nice. Of course, they could talk Arabic far better than we could. And they were far, well, they were better educated in every way, but they didn't show off about it at all. They were a very nice lot. And I reckon the Sudan political was number two only to the Indian Salon.
Did you learn a lot about the Sudan from the political service?
Well, yes, but I didn't realise I did in a way. Because, you see, I mean, I wasn't awfully good at polo. I played polo, but I wasn't awfully good. I was far more interested in playing squash rackets. And the governor, Sir Douglas Newbold, he wasn't Sir Douglas then, but he became civil secretary of the Sudan during the war, was marvellous. And luckily, I'd been dubbing with, not the same time, but he was there too. And so he was very kind to me, and we played squash quite a lot. And I learned an awful lot from him. It wasn't until later on that I realised he was learning quite a lot about the Camel Corps, about me, from me. And it amused me too that occasionally he would ring me up. We talked about upping and that sort of thing. And he would occasionally ring me up and say, "Peter, the day after tomorrow, come and I come and have a quiet meal with you and we'll talk about upping. I've got nothing to do." And I would say, "Yes, grand sir, do." He would come, and we would have grand talk. I would find out later on that he had avoided going to a party which he didn't want. It was, and of course I went also on, as his ADC, although he was kind enough not to call me his ADC, and of course I went up to Nahud, I went up to Fasha, and I met them all there, and as a result of that, I got to know them all very well. Another one, actually, his number two, is now Sir Garwin Bell, who was very, very well thought of, and so on, and attends actually the Sudan Defence Force dinner, and we used to play together, and I mean, frequently. I mean, if I was had troubles from, I would ring up Garwin. And vice versa. We were on that sort of net. But whereas in the, probably in other places, like East Africa and West Africa, they would have their fun largely at the club. We had a club, but we didn't use it all that much, except on special occasions like Christmas and that sort of thing. Because we preferred to do our enjoyments and entertaining in our own houses, in our own bungalows, and that was, we felt better. But there was a club, and that was largely used for people passing through if they had nowhere to stay. But not much else, and I mean there were facilities and servants and that sort of thing. There was also a swimming bath there. But we had, of course, the worst squash courts and tennis courts and that sort of thing, but they were only not properly. Were they part of the club? They were part of the whole sort of outfit. And of course the polo ground too.
Apart from members of the political service, did you meet other British or indeed Europeans socially?
Oh yes, the whole lot.
What sort of people?
Well, we were very friendly with the vets, because I mean they played polo and that sort of thing, and we liked them a lot, and most of them were Scots or Irish and that sort of thing, but we were very fond of them. We liked the doctors. Then, of course, there were the more lowly lot, so-called lowly lot, who on the railways and the public works departments, but they were all awfully nice as far as I can remember, and we got on all very well. And although, I mean, they were in the social strata, supposed to be, you know, rather low, and I mean, there was a precious little difference between us, and there was no sort of social snobbery at all. The one rule that we were all told, actually, was that we would be sacked forthwith, or we were caught messing about with another man's wife, whether he was or anybody's wife, and that was about the only rule really that we had, but it paid off very, very well.
And was the rule adhered to, do you think?
Well, I've never heard it not being. At least I have once, and then the chap was sacked straight away.
Was that during your time or earlier?
As far as I know, it never occurred, but I did hear rumours it did occur once.
Were relationships with African women at all common
amongst
British officers?
No, hardly at all, but there was one or two occasions. And then they were allowed to marry Sunnis' wives, and they were put in a tukla in the side there. It was all rather hushed up. And I only know one person of ours who did it.
Was it frowned upon, do you think?
He was such a nice chap that we couldn't say no, and he was fairly high up too, and furthermore, he did it largely because he became a first-class Arabic interpreter, and one of the reasons we made the excuse that he did it was to become a first-class Arabic interpreter. So that's where it was. But no, I mean, I think it was done, but I mean, I never did it, because I didn't like their smell, and I hated the possibility of venereal disease, and that was possibly it was. But there's some of them were very attractive and very graceful, but I didn't like the smell and the other thing.
Was there any other outlet, other European women in the country, for instance?